Good morning, everyone. I would like to call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. And today is April 9th, right? And a quorum is present. So I'm going to start by reading our safety decorum statement. So we, in order to ensure a productive and safe environment, we ask all attendees to maintain a high level of decorum. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Please refrain from applause and other audible demonstrations. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior not permitted. To ensure we get to hear from everyone, testifiers should limit their remarks to the specified time. For safety reasons, do not stand or sit in the aisles. If you need seating accommodations, please alert a sergeant staff wearing gold ties. If you were issued an entrance ticket, please keep it with you. You may need it for re-entry if you leave the room. State troopers and sergeant staff are stationed throughout the room to ensure the safety of all. Okay, so the first order, the next order of business, I should say, is to approve the minutes that are before us that are from, let's see, we have to actually... Okay, we have two sets here. So we have minutes from March 25th and March 26th. So let's start with the March 25th minutes. Is there, does anyone want to move the minutes?
I'll move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Chair Scott moves approval of the minutes of March 25th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. And we have a set from March 26th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of March 26th?
Cheers, I'll move those as well, sorry.
Right. Yeah. We'll just... All right. Well, so Chair Scott moves the minutes of March 26th. Is there any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. And those minutes are approved. Thank you, everyone. So, okay. Moving on. First bill on the agenda today is House File 4077, and Representative Greenman and Representative Roach are going to co-present this bill. And since neither of them are on the committee, I will move that House File 4077 be re-referred to the General Register. Correct, Representative Greenman?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. So the bill is before us, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4077 is a simple bipartisan bill that prohibits local municipalities from entering into secret nondisclosure agreements with private entities. This issue has brought together folks from across the political spectrum, including me and my co-author, Representative Roach, to protect citizens' right to know what their government is doing and safeguard the proud tradition of public transparency that Minnesotans expect. In a minute, you're going to hear from local electeds and citizens who will make it clear why this bipartisan, why there's bipartisan urgency for the state to act now to prohibit this practice of corporate secrecy from corrupting our public processes. And as this committee well knows, in Minnesota, we have developed a comprehensive framework of public transparency laws, open meeting laws, data practices laws, that carefully balance the public's right to know what their elected officials are doing and the needs of governing. These laws, Chapter 13, create a presumption that meetings and information are public unless there's a strong public interest in protecting private information. This legal framework has been carefully worked out and executed over decades, and this bill does not change, alter, expand, restrict, or in any way touch Chapter 13. What this bill does do is say that you cannot circumvent Chapter 13 and their transparency requirements with secret agreements and secret meetings worked out behind the public's back. See, NDAs are public, are private contracts drafted by companies forced on local governments for the purpose of hiding from public view whatever information the company has determined they don't want to share, including in most instances the existence of the NDA and the project itself. We're talking here, though, about local elected officials or folks who are appointed or hired by taxpayers to represent the public, making secret agreements to hide information from the public for the benefit of the corporations who are trying to keep their plans secret. This bill ends that practice. It makes clear that private entities cannot circumvent Chapter 13 transparency with secret meetings and secret agreements. It prohibits, it's very simple, it's only a page. It prohibits a municipality from entering into a non-disclosure agreement that would restrict that municipality from disclosing information to the public about land development, economic development, and projects funded by the government, unless there are other state or federal laws that require it. And it requires a disclosure of any of those NDAs that violate the provision. What it does not do is require more or less disclosure under Chapter 13 and what current law already requires. It doesn't change any data classifications. It doesn't change information about what Chapter 13 currently holds as non-public or as confidential or as public. In working on this bill, I've had lots of conversations, and one of the things that keeps coming up, which is not the jurisdiction of this committee, but is about these early conversations that happen and the importance of protecting the confidentiality of that information. And when I talked to nonpartisan staff about it, what I heard was that's an important conversation for Chapter 13 and whether that information is something that we want to, on balance, keep public, but it doesn't have anything to do with this bill. So I will just close and turn it over to my co-author by saying that this is a simple transparency bill, and Minnesotans are asking around the state us to protect their ability to both know what their government is doing, what meetings are being had, and weigh in, and have the ability to weigh in on that. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to Representative Roach.
All right. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Welcome to the committee, Representative Roach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 4077 is simple and overdue. When public tax dollars, bonds, or abatements fund a project, local governments cannot be gagged by NDAs. Secret NDAs. No more backroom deals. Developers will no longer bully elected officials into silence while our communities bear the costs. This bill protects taxpayers and restores trust within the community. People deserve to know what's happening in their own backyards and their communities. They are the stakeholders. It's bipartisan common sense. It passed in our committee here in the House unanimously because transparency isn't Republican or Democrat. It's Minnesota. This bill keeps legitimate trade secrets safe under existing law in state and federal. We just end the gag orders on public impacts. Sunlight delivers better outcomes, stronger negotiations, fairer deals, and decisions that actually serve our communities. House File 4077 puts people first. Let's pass it today. Let's restore transparency. Let's work for the people and not the special interests. And so I urge a yes vote on this to move it to the general register. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So we have a number of testifiers signed up today. And so let's start with Commissioner Ashley Grimm, and we're going to ask everyone to please stick to 2 minutes. And the commissioner, I think, is on Zoom. So welcome to the committee.
Everyone, thank you so much for having me. I'm Ashley Grimm. I'm the 3rd District St. Louis County Commissioner. And what I want to share about that job first is that my work as a commissioner relies almost 100% on trust. I've worked with a lot of folks at the state because we're the state's trusted partners, and community members come to us on some of the most difficult days of their lives. And I ground us in that because as a commissioner, I haven't seen anything erode trust as quickly or as broadly as when commissioners signed NDAs last year. The NDAs in St. Louis County, which are still in effect today, granted a company up to 5 years to build relationships and lobby a data center project without the public presence. In the months that followed the NDAs being exposed, it was justified as normal and necessary, and it was neither. It was the first time in my two terms that commissioners had signed NDAs at the county. All other economic development projects had gone through staff at that phase. So the key thing that you're considering banning here today is not access to information businesses need to develop. They have that with staff. It is the one thing staff can't build. It's political will before the public is at the table. Lastly, I want to share the really good news here is that over the last 6 months, I've seen this discussion bring people together in a way I don't know if I've seen before at the county. I mean, you'll hear from other folks, but hundreds of people ad hoc coming together, building together with this common mission. And I had the honor of seeing this pass unanimously in the last House committee, and just can't say strongly enough how much your community and commissioners like myself are behind you. So thank you for considering this.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Tom Berg. Welcome to the committee. If you would please just state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah. Hello, Chair and committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Tom Berg. I am the mayor of Lonsdale, and it's an honor to be here to represent the amazing people of my community. I am in support of House File 4077 to ban elected officials, staff, and appointees from signing non-disclosure agreements with private developers. You've heard and will continue to hear a lot on data centers, but let's take this back to the position of elected office. A big reason that I ran for mayor of Lonsdale was due to the honesty, integrity, and transparency that was severely lacking over the years, and the city needed it back to the forefront for the betterment of Lonsdale's residents, business owners, and its future. Just recently, council had a private land transaction that consisted of a comp plan amendment plus rezoning to a planned unit development that was controversial for a PUD. No, it wasn't a data center. It was a market rate apartment with zero income requirements. But before, during the concept phase, I solicited every bit of feedback, of positive and negative input. Anything I couldn't immediately answer, I followed up with a high priority. In addition, all questions were gathered, and I asked them to my city staff during a packed council meeting. I also took questions from the floor during new business. I made it very clear we weren't adjourning until every single question was answered. We didn't hire our attorney to speak for us and staff. We did our jobs, and an NDA would directly affect us from doing the work. I was elected by the community. I answer to my community. This bill will protect future elected officials, appointees, and most importantly, all the work our staff continues to do to foster a more informed community. If we're making the excuse and judging future economic development being in the balance of signing NDAs, let me be clear. Forget the additional tax revenue. They don't need to be here, and we need to make a strong statement to our state that our integrity is not for sale. Without a strong sense of community, you don't have economic development. Transparency isn't reactionary, it's proactive. It's high time to get back to common sense and ethics. This bill supports both of them. I'm proud of the bipartisan support on this bill, and I urge all of you to vote in favor of House File 4077. Thank you for your time, attention, and God bless all of you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Kathy Johnson. Welcome to the committee. And after Kathy Johnson will be Rebecca Gilbertson on Zoom. So welcome to the committee. If you would just please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for letting me testify. I'm Kathy Johnson. I represent myself and I represent the Coalition for
Ms. Johnson, if you could just speak closely into the mic. You have a softer voice.
I represent both myself and the Coalition for Responsible Data Center Development. As a 47-year resident of Farmington, I was outraged to learn that Tract Land Development of Colorado has proposed one of the largest hyperscale data centers in the country to be nestled between three residential neighborhoods. That was 2 years ago. I learned about the project because people that lived within 350 feet received a postcard stating that a technology park would be coming to the area and rezoning was to be discussed. Two savvy neighbors passed out flyers inviting neighbors to gather in the park, and thus the coalition began. We had a standing room only crowd at that first public meeting. A proposed project plan was introduced. The Planning Commission chair said he'd never seen it before. The city planners and councilors were working with a developer for 7 or 8 months behind closed doors secretly. We now represent a template that's coming in all over the state and nation for that matter. Developers come to a small or rural community with faux promises of permanent jobs and the promise of property tax, and in exchange, the city signs an NDA and promises water from its domestic water allocation to supply the data center. No citizen input whatsoever. The template's being used all over the state to convince naive and tax-hungry small towns to work against their own citizens and approve a plan behind citizens' backs. At the first public presentation, developers literally said, "We'll be good neighbors. We stay away from residential areas, and we have a long way to go in permitting. Don't worry, we'll obey statutes and ordinances." We subsequently found out that statutes and ordinances were either non-existent or simply waived by a compliant city council. In recovered emails, the city asked the developer how to work with us, the dissension in the community. Subsequently, the planner asked the developer, "Are you ready to go public with this yet?" That was about 7 or 8 months into the process.
Ms. Johnson, I have to
ask
you. At
no time were we given the opportunity to have input. Meetings were presentations with no dialogue. One council member voted against it said he'd never seen such an opaque process in all of his years of city government, and the developer literally got everything they wanted. As citizens, we were silenced, both by a city working for the developer and a developer who sees Farmington as low-hanging fruit for their own ambitions, all happening behind the secrecy of an NDA.
Ms.
Johnson, support the Greenman-Roach bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry to interrupt you. Rebecca Gilbertson on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name and please go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the council. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. I'm a resident in Hermantown, Minnesota. My comments are in support of HF 4077. A blitzkrieg is a sudden, coordinated effort meant to paralyze citizens. This is a German word used to describe military tactics during World War II. We're unfortunately finding that this word also applies to the planning of the proposed hyperscale data center in Hermantown, Minnesota. 22 NDAs were signed in St. Louis County. They include the county attorney, communication staff, St. Louis County commissioners, and local government staff. Those individuals, at least the St. Louis County commissioner, mentioned that he had to actually sign an NDA in order to find out about the project. Such things have consequences, and so citizens asked for a Data Practices Act request, produced 1,600 pages of planning behind the scenes. The Hermantown Google project is the only project in the state that's actually planned on top of residential dwellings. And so I'm here in front of you this morning asking you to please support HF 4077, and also, and I cannot underscore this enough, citizens are begging for data center reform. This is Greater Minnesota's immigration crisis. We continue to ask you to join us in advocating for a pause to study large-scale data center development while it can still make an impact. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jonathan Cotter from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Cotter, Director of Healthcare and Commerce Policy with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, representing more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes in all industries across the state. We are here today in opposition to House File 4077, a bill which would inhibit economic development in Minnesota by banning NDAs for economic development. We have reviewed the author's amendment. Not sure if we adopted that, but we realize that it removes retroactivity, but it doesn't address our core concern that the bill restricts the use of non-disclosure agreements during the economic development discussions. In practice, non-disclosure agreements are used during project development discussions, particularly when companies are considering expansion, relocation, or major investment. At that stage, businesses often need to share sensitive information about their operations, financial projections, and competitive strategy. If they cannot rely on some level of confidentiality during those conversations, economic development opportunities may be impacted. Since this bill has been introduced, we have heard from businesses of multiple sizes that they rely on NDAs to protect competitive financial information, intellectual property, job planning, joint ventures, and other project-specific details. This includes companies ranging from regional convenience stores and gas stations to manufacturing, warehouses, technology firms, medical technology firms, and biotech firms, all of which use NDAs to engage with municipalities and pursue growth opportunities in Minnesota. States allow non-disclosure agreements in economic development negotiations, and companies often evaluate multiple states when making investment decisions. A blanket prohibition would place Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage, risking the loss of investment, jobs, and tax growth. For these reasons, we believe the bill risks undermining economic development efforts in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Dalton Danielson from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, good morning. My name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Members, transparency and public trust are important values, and businesses that partner with local governments understand that public dollars come with public accountability. However, we respectfully oppose House File 4077 because it goes far beyond existing public records law and in practice creates a restrictive environment that would make Minnesota significantly less competitive for major business investments. And let's be clear, this goes far beyond data centers. There is nothing inherently nefarious about NDAs. In reality, limited and temporary confidentiality is often a prerequisite for investment discussions. Companies and local governments alike value the confidence and security they provide when discussing proprietary information, site selection strategies, financing structures, and sensitive data, particularly in early stage negotiations. Without that protection, many companies simply will not come to the table. Members, to put it plainly, this means that communities across Minnesota, your communities, may not even be considered for the next $1 million, $10 million, or $100 million investment. Furthermore, this bill would also undermine local control. Despite what's being stated, none of your local leaders are being forced to sign NDAs. But the fact of the matter is communities differ dramatically in their economic needs and competitive pressures. Your community may not want or need a large-scale investment or development, and that's just fine. But House File 4077 replaces local judgment with a one-size-fits-all mandate from the state, even when local officials may believe temporary confidentiality is in the community's best interest. To summarize, while we believe it to be well-intentioned, House File 4077 would stifle Minnesota's access to new investment and the jobs and economic growth that accompany it. We respectfully ask this committee to vote no on the bill as it stands today. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So that concludes the testifiers who signed up today. So we will close testimony and move to member discussion. And Representative Feist.
Thank you. And I'm going to go all nerd on this. this. As co-chair of the Commission on Data Practices, I have some thoughts. A lot of times we all have our positions and the things that we say are more just like telling the public, but I am going to try and convince my colleagues who might have some concerns about this bipartisan bill. There is a rule in the Data Practices Act around trade secrets that already exists, that already protects the interests that were raised by the Chamber of Commerce and the most recent speaker, the Minnesota Business Partnership. And that is a four-part test. To qualify as a trade secret and therefore to have that data be non-public, it must be supplied by the affected organization, the private entity, to the government. So information provided by these companies to the government. It must be a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process, so incredibly broad. So it's a process, perhaps, of developing data centers in Minnesota, a process of looking into investment opportunities across the country. So it must also be, quote, subject of efforts by the private company that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. And I think that the Chamber of Commerce gave some examples of where data should be non-public. It is in the business interests of those companies, of localities, of our state. And then finally, it must derive independent economic value from not being generally known by other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure. And that's exactly what the Chamber of Commerce is concerned about, that there could be some anti-competitiveness impact if information is disclosed. And so just to reiterate, the Data Practices Act already protects trade secrets, which in my mind encompass a lot of the types of development that we've discussed today. So I wanted to make that point. And then I also wanted to make the point that private companies and government entities are not allowed to contract out of compliance with the Data Practices Act. Here in Minnesota, we are not most states. I noticed the Chamber of Commerce letter talks about how most states do it one way, but Minnesota does it in a pretty unique way, where all data is presumed to be public unless we otherwise designate it as non-public. And we did that for a reason, because we understand that transparency serves the people of Minnesota and that it is a value in and of itself that we care about. And so I just wanted to make the specific point that we have made it explicit in our laws that governments and companies are not allowed to contract out of the Chapter 13. And that is 1305 Subdivision 11 made it explicit. I think it was before my time. I don't remember this. But made it explicit that government contracts are, in fact, subject to the Data Practices Act. But again, trade secrets rule means that a lot of this data that we're concerned about is actually still non-public. And so just to conclude, this transparency matters. We heard from a lot of people who wanted to be part of a discussion, and we should want the people in the communities that are being impacted to have a voice in this process, and that's why we structured the Data Practices Act the way we did. And so I think this is a really important bill. It's received bipartisan support. It has bipartisan authors. I would really encourage all of us to support it today, and I'd like a roll call. Thank you.
All right, a roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, and many of the questions that I was going to ask were already addressed by Representative Feist, and you know, because of that, I just I can cut to the chase and get to my question. As she said, and I believe one of the testifiers was referring to the fact that they were able to get emails from the city through, I assume they did a FOIA request, so would this change anything? Would they, if you did a FOIA request, you'd still be able to find out the information that's going on, wouldn't you, Representative Greenman?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you asked that question because the answer is yes, if they're following the Chapter 13. But, and we heard this a lot of this testimony in the last committee, what we heard over and over again is the horse has left the station, the horse has left the barn, the train has left the station. Oftentimes it is months, and I think we heard 8 months, years later. And when people are making public decision, when staff is spending taxpayer dollars to develop these programs, those months matter. And all of this would do would say it would give control back to the local electeds who can decide under their chapter 13 obligations, what are they affirmatively disclosing? What are they required to hold confidential? But either way, in this case, the delay that happened for years and years actually subverts the public process.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So what you're saying is the problem is with agencies not following the FOIA rules. And I understand the frustration with that. I have a FOIA request for something that happened in the public safety committee hearing over a year ago that I haven't got information back on. So I understand that frustration, but that's not the problem with the law. That's the problem with the agency that's not following the FOIA request. And I'm glad you asked for the roll call, Representative Feist, and I'll be voting no.
Okay. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Right. Representative Roach. Representative Finke, I apologize. Before we go to you, let's let Representative Roach respond.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to comment on that. While, yes, this doesn't – currently right now, members of the public – can do a FOIA request. But my question is this. Why do members of the community have to dig for the truth? Why? Why can't the truth just be at the surface? The communities the local government represents the people. So they hide behind an NDA to buy time, knowing that many people don't know what they don't know. And now they've got to dig for the truth to get the truth? I think it's the wrong approach in government. What we do here at the state level is transparent. When we do bonding bills, we don't do secret contracts. So why are our local governments doing that? This bill is good governance.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. That's essentially what I had to say. I will add that, we're talking about data centers in a lot of different committees in a lot of different ways, right? We are talking about disclosure and non-disclosure and secret development. We're talking about water usage. We're talking about many different ways that these are going to impact our communities. And I think one of the reasons that we're doing that is because we are being told, we as community members, right, we as the people of Minnesota, that these data centers, I was told this year, right? These data centers are happening, right? We just need to get on board because this is happening. And I think that what we are seeing in this conversation and in other conversations is that's not true. That's not real. That's not how the world works. We are lawmakers who make laws to determine whether or not things go forward in the way that they are. And to Representative Roach's point, we are representatives, and the stakeholders in our work are people, right? The stakeholders are not Google. They are a part of the stakeholder conversation and the development, but the people that we are elected to represent and all of our local electeds are people. And the idea that we are being told and by stakeholders across the political spectrum that this is just happening, so we need to just figure out how to let it happen, is a very problematic way for us to move as a body. We are, if it happens, it happens, and it's because we decided that that's what we think is good for Minnesota, not because someone else told us we're already too far down this stream and we just need to let it go. So I just want to put back into the space in front of us, nothing is inevitable. We make choices, and choices have outcomes. And we can either choose to understand what's happening in communities where people feel like they're being left in the dark, blindsided, or we can have truth come to the surface. Truth will out. It's going to happen one way or another. I would say we should do it at the front.
Thank you. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question probably for Mr. Hopkins. So on line 1.15, this applies to non-disclosure agreements or other contract with a private person. I know in this committee we've talked before about a person can mean a corporation, and so I just am curious that with the word private here, is that still the situation? If he could explain what private person means in this context. Thanks.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, say this person would include bodies corporate and politic, but it wouldn't include public corporations. So the modifier private here is would likely be read to exclude any sort of government entity.
Representative Mueller? Okay. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there anything right now that prevents a local government from saying they don't want to sign an NDA with a developer?
Representative Roach.
Yeah, on the surface, no. But what's happening, and I think it's pretty clear, is some of these corporations and these organizations are strategically going to communities that desperately need the tax revenue, that are dealing with increased property taxes, increased mandates on their municipalities, and these entities are strategically coercing and isolating those communities and having them engage in NDAs with the carrot dangling over their head that you need this, your people need this. And I just don't think that's right. So many of those elected officials or those staff members of those local communities, of those local governments, feel that they have to. And that's not something that I think should even be there. And so you're right. I will give you that, Representative Bliss. Is, you know, if a council wants to take a position currently to not sign NDAs, they could. But that creates an unlevel playing field when some do and others don't.
Representative Bliss, follow up.
Yeah, just a comment, I guess. So earlier, Representative Grimmon, you said this puts the power in the locals' hands, the local electeds' hands. In my opinion, it takes it away from them. And this bill, I mean, I understand the concern with data centers. I do. That they're a big issue and that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, this bill covers everything. If my community wants a gas station, if New Orton's wants to open up down the street and they want to sign an NDA, this is going to affect them. It's way too broad, just way too broad. So I think for that reason, I'm a no. The data center conversations we should continue to keep having, but on that front, I'm a no vote.
All right, Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grimmon, does this take away local control, kind of what Representative Bliss was getting at?
Representative Grimmon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, because Chapter 13 lays out very clearly what is and is not public, non-public, confidential. And if there are those decisions that a local government wants to make about when they share affirmatively information, what this does is say it's going to be in those local officials' hands because they're going to make the public policy interest. What these non-disclosure agreements are doing, which are they are written by, in many cases, and one of to what you said, Representative Bliss, the power differential of a multinational corporation in a town of 5,000 is actually a pressure point that most folks feel like they can't. They can't say no to. But in this case, what we're doing is saying it sits with the local government to follow Chapter 13 and to decide when and where and how they, under their legal obligations, present that information.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what we're getting at here is that local politicians, your mayors, your county commissioners, your city political figures are all voted by the people. So don't we entrust those people to make the right decisions for those municipalities? So aren't we hindering their ability right now to make decisions for the best interest of the local community when we as a state of Minnesota are saying you need to operate this way at this point in time? We're making a decision that is going to be a one size fits all for the state of Minnesota instead of allowing local municipalities to make a right decision for what's in best interest for them as a whole. Right now the law states that we're not forcing mayors, we're not forcing municipalities to actually go into an NDA in the first place. So I think right now we're going down the wrong path. And like Representative Bliss says, you know, the data center conversation should be had a little bit more in depth. But right now, I think what we're doing is we're having big government come in and dictating how small government should operate.
So, okay, thank you, Representative Durant. So rather than respond, because we time's getting a little short, what I'm going to do is we have Representative Rarick, Representative Scott wants to make a comment, then I will allow you to close up, okay? So Representative Rarick, and I should just say before she speaks, I neglected to, like, welcome a couple of new members to our committee at the beginning, and Representative Novotny, since we served together in another committee, I'm kind of used to being in committee with you, but welcome to this committee, and the same to Representative Rarick, who is online today. Representative Novotny,
did you want to say returning.
Pardon me?
We're not new, we're returning, like a boomerang.
Returning, that's correct, yes. Welcome, Representative Rarick. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's very good to be back today. Unfortunately, I am remote just for this hearing. This whole medical thing is something else. So my question is actually for Representative Greenman. You know, we've had some concerns about how broad and how wide that this bill is and how far sweeping it is. And really, I think I understand the question to be data centers. And listen, I have a data center that wants to come to Monticello, and my community is outraged. I understand the outrage. I understand the concern. They're concerned about the power usage. You know, we actually have the Monticello nuclear power plant right next door, and so we've hosted that for decades. We've borne that burden of that facility, of all of the risks that come with that as a community. So I understand that. But my question is, because the issue really has been data centers, I haven't heard any other concern rise to that level as the data centers. Would you consider narrowing this bill? And obviously we can't do that today because we have an amendment deadline, but would you consider narrowing it so that it covers just the data centers and not everything else? It's all far sweeping.
Okay, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just point you back to Mayor Tom Burke, who said this was not just about data centers. It was about PUDs. It was about all sorts of economic development when public taxpayer dollars and public decision-making is at stake. I think the reason that we have seen it in a data center context recently is because of how aggressively these companies like Meta and others have used them. But what we know, one, is they are, and we heard the chamber say, they are being widely used. And that's actually news to me, because when I talked to a lot of local and state governments or city governments, they've said the opposite. But I think it matters because the principle is there shouldn't be secret meetings and secret agreements behind the backs of taxpayers to withhold information. Chapter 13 is what governs their responsibilities. And so I am certainly open to talk, because I do think that it, today in these agreements, what we heard in this committee and others is Farmington, Hermantown, North Mankato, Pine Island are all dealing with it and more. But I don't think it is just a data center issue, and I think that that's a mistake to think that it's just a data center practice.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both of the bill's authors, and thanks for the conversation over Easter Passover break, Representative Greenman. And I've had a little while to noodle over this, and I keep coming back to what current law is. And it was mentioned before, Representative Feist, you brought this up, 1305 sub 11. And I just want to read it quickly. If a government entity enters into a contract with a private person to perform any of its functions, all of the data created, collected, received, stored, used, maintained, or disseminated by the private person in performing those functions is subject to the requirements of this chapter, and the private person must comply with those requirements as if it were the government entity. All contracts entered into by a government entity must include a notice that the requirements of this subdivision apply to the contract. Failure to include the notice in the contract does not invalidate the application of this subdivision. So even if they don't include that piece, it doesn't make them get off from having to obey current law. And then it talks about the remedies that are in current law for this. And my point with all this is this information is already available. if you do a data request to your city and ask, do you have any NDAs, they have to tell you. And if you ask what the particulars of that are, except for trade secret and some other protected data that's already in current law, they have to comply with it. I will give the example, a couple of examples, of where in the past there have been things that happened in one thing in my city and one thing that we face down here in the data practices realm. The city of Andover wanted to expand their community center and add another sheet of ice. Well, the train had kind of already left the station, like you're just talking about. Like the public was, and there were no NDAs involved, but the public was not paying attention. And they didn't realize that this was going to raise their taxes. Now the public is on alert, right? Just as these folks in other cities, and regrettably, I mean, we all learn by the mistakes that we make. And government can try, we have all kinds of transparency laws on the books here, but people, the people of Minnesota have to rely on them. And they have to do the digging themselves, because there's no way that a government, a city or a county government, is going to put on their website every single contract that they have. It's up to the city to go, or it's up to the people to find out for themselves. And I can guarantee you, with all the talk of this data center business, I don't have an opinion on that. I would be upset probably if there was one going in as well. But let's then regulate that. But right now in the city of Andover, they're going to be developing an old vegetable farm. There are two options at play. One of those is 1,500 new houses going in. It's a strain on the taxpayers currently. Roads, bridges, infrastructure, water, all those things have to be taken into consideration. And because of what happened in previous years with this second sheet of ice, people are on alert and they are participating in their local government. And my point here is, folks, the information is available. We don't need to add to the statute books. If we all do a data request today of our own cities and our own counties and say, hey, do you have any NDAs and what are they? They have to tell you. They have to abide by current law. Part of this as well is the local units of government, the people that work for these local cities and the city councils, that sort of thing. They're not familiar with what their rights are and what they have to disclose. They're afraid that an NDA means they can't say anything about anything, when in fact that's not right. And we have an Office of Data Practices that will help people walk through that and educate local levels of government so that they know what they can and cannot disclose in agreements like this. I don't see the necessity for this bill. And while I sympathize, because no one likes to be surprised by stuff like this, but it doesn't have to be that way. On a state level, we struggle with a lot of law enforcement surveillance popping up. We never knew it existed, right? We find out after the fact by a citizen or someone that does a data practices request that, you know, whatever agency has whatever piece of technology. So what I'm encouraging here is for citizens to be more diligent. And I know that's hard. There's a lot of things in life to be watching for. But because I feel like you can already find out this information, I can't support the bill today in its current form. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just have a brief statement myself, and then I'm going to let you both, if you would, briefly close up, okay, because we do need to move on. But Chair Scott, you know, what you just read, I don't think it applies here. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Mr. Hopkins will have to weigh in here. But what you read has to do with when the government is handing over its functions to a private entity, which we know happens a lot. That's what I heard in what you read. Maybe I could be corrected if I'm wrong. But, you know, my general feeling, too, about this bill and something that hasn't been mentioned is that, you know, we have this value, this belief that sunlight is a disinfectant. And right now in our legislature, we are very concerned about fraud. We're very concerned about misuse of funds. We're very concerned about corruption, although I don't think we've seen actual corruption within government here, but could happen, happens in a lot of places. And we need sunlight as disinfectant. So I think this bill, one of the things that it does is it helps us to prevent fraud, to prevent self-dealing, to prevent corruption, because when you don't get to hide what you're doing, you're less likely to engage in that. And, you know, we've got lots and lots of people in government across our state, and, you know, I just think it's kind of a good preventive move. So I fully support the bill, and I don't know if I'd like to give each of you an opportunity to just briefly wrap up here, and then we'll have the vote. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate the dialogue and the open discussion. You know, I know many of it, many of the discussion is you know, talks about data centers, and I want to be clear. I'm pro data center. I'm not anti data center. I just want transparency within my community. I think the residents of our communities want transparency. With the current environment we're in today, the political environment, whether it be, you know, reports that are redacted, no transparency, the public wants to know that their local governments, their state governments, their federal governments work for them, not special interest. I got elected to represent the people. I didn't come here to represent special interest. I didn't come here to represent lobbyists. I came here to represent the good people of House District 58B. And I think this bill provides much needed transparency to those constituents and people across the state that are asking and demanding that their local governments be held accountable and are open and honest with them about how they're spending their money and how they're going about economic development. And I urge a yes vote, and I urge every member in here to represent the people and not special interests.
Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if you have to leave for bonding.
I do.
I will wrap us up here and just say, this is a very real world example that we saw in this room. We heard from Mayor Berg about the hours of time that he spent publicly responding before a PUD. And I want to contrast that with what we saw in Rosemont, a city planning commission that held their monthly meeting on December 19th, 2022. There were lots of conversations. They had a public hearing open to talk about a proposed project. There were lots of questions, but the public hearing to approve the secret, very extensive development of the master plan lasted 6 minutes and was given a code name called Project Bigfoot. Because in July of that year, Rosemont city officials had signed an NDA that included complete secrecy over the existence of the agreement, that the NDA, the fact or nature of the discussions between the parties, and the entity or company behind the project, and even the existence of that project. It was only after the project was approved by the city council and announced to the public that Project Bigfoot was revealed to be a 715,000 square foot, $800 million data center for Meta. And so that, I think, is what we're talking about. We are talking about the public having the right to know. And the last thing I will just say, to echo what Representative Roach said, which is the question here is, what is our job? And we heard the CEO and the business lobby talk about their interests in protecting their secret ability to advance their private interests. And that's their prerogative, but that is not our job here. Our job can't just be to say citizens need to be more diligent, and being more diligent means understanding and knowing that their elected officials are signing secret agreements to have secret meetings with giant corporations. And so all we're doing here is saying, you can't sign those agreements. You have to follow Chapter 13. And again, what this is about is not representing any of their interests. What it is about is the public needing the information to be able to participate in the decisions that their government is making. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye. And before we go on, I should renew my motion that House File 4077 be re-referred to the General Register. And the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Chair Scott.
No.
Chair Scott, no. Vice Chair Finke?
Aye.
Finke, aye. Vice Chair Duran?
No.
Duran, no. Representative Bliss?
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran?
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Novotny?
No.
Novotny, no. Representative Rarick?
Rarick, no.
Rarick, no. Representative Steer?
No.
Steer, no. Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Van Binsbergen, no. 7-7.
So on a vote of 7-7, the motion does not prevail and the bill does not advance. Thank you, Representative Greenman. All right, we're going to move along and try to make up some time, hopefully. And just so everyone knows, the 4478, we're not going to hear today. That's going to be heard on Tuesday when Chair Scott has the gavel. So we're going to move now to House File 3809. Representative Dotseff is here. Representative Hussein is here to co-present. And the chair will move that House File 3809 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee. And the bill has been moved. And I understand there's a DE4 amendment. Let's see. 3809. And Representative Dotseff, welcome. Did you want to move the DE4? I assume you want to adopt that right away, right?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move the amendment.
Okay. So the chair will move the DE4 amendment to get the bill in the order in which the authors would like to present it. Is there any discussion to the DE4 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, maybe what I'll do is I'll let Representative Hussein explain the amendment a little bit detail first, if you'd like, and I'll go into the bill.
All right. Representative Hussein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me here. The amendment is simple. The penalty was $500, but now it's $300. And the minor will be in the list of the housing application, but if the family members or adult get evicted, it's not going to be on the record for that child.
Okay. All right. And then did you, Representative Dotseff, do you want to go ahead and explain your portion of
that? Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3809, as amended, is about improving safety in multifamily housing while maintaining strong legal safeguards and fairness. This bill reflects real-world conditions in apartment communities and a balanced stakeholder agreement. As you can see, we've got bipartisan agreement throughout this bill. Expanded protection language. This amendment broadens language from just not just residents, but to include landlords, employers, employees, contractors. This is a practical fix. Apartment buildings are a shared environment. Hallways, stairways, parking lots. Safety threats don't just impact tenants. They impact maintenance workers, staff, property managers, and others on site. This change ensures law reflects how multifamily housing actually operates, not narrows definition. Real-world safety conditions. Multifamily housing involves constant interactions between residents, staff, visitors. When a serious safety issue arises, it affects everyone in those shared spaces. This amendment that we just covered also individuals are represent consider not just those in the lease. Maintain strong legal safeguards. This bill does not weaken due process at all. It preserves key protections, requires a sworn affidavit. Specific factual claims that must be presented. Includes judicial review before expedited action is granted. Maintains strict service timelines. Imposes civil penalties of misuse. Bottom line, accountability remains intact. And abuse of this process is discouraged. I will open up if there's any question, or Madam Chair, that.
All right, thank you. And we didn't have any testifiers on the bill. Okay,
Madam Chair, maybe I'll mention that we've got Ron Elwood here if he'd like to make any comments in regards to this bill as well. We've actually worked with him and some of the other stakeholders too.
Okay, well, let's see if there's any discussion from members, and we'll see if maybe we have questions. Is there a discussion from members? Seeing none. Let's see, Mr. Elwood, I don't see you, but I know you're here. But did you want to make any comment? No comment needed. Okay. All right, everybody. Yeah, we're all used up after that last bill. Okay, so with that then, thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 3809 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
We're done.
Okay, so as I mentioned, we're not going to take up 4478. We will move now to House File 3363, Representative Freiberg. Welcome to the committee. And so I will move that House File 3363 be placed on the General Register. And Representative Freiberg, welcome, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have the A16 amendment, which puts the bill kind of in the shape I would like.
Okay.
I can also wait. I know there's another amendment, too. We can do the amendments after whatever your pleasure is.
Well, let me find it here. 1 second. Okay, in the packet, I have an A17 amendment. We don't have another amendment.
Oh.
Oh, okay. So we failed to get that printed, I guess. But there is so.
Okay. How about I could just
yeah,
describe the bill
if
staff
and
wants to address the issue with the other amendment. We're not happy to take the A17 first also.
Okay. Go ahead, please, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Scott. Appreciate your consideration of this bill. Sorry, just catching up on my notes here. So I developed this bill in consultation with Campaign Finance Board Director Jeff Sigurdson after the events of this past June, and we've since incorporated some suggestions from the Senate. I don't really want to revisit the events of last June in committee. Honestly, I'm not sure how well I'd keep it together doing so. But suffice it to say that the public availability of home addresses of many legislators has put our safety at risk. And we have kind of a heightened political environment that we find ourselves in, too, so this is intended to address those issues. There are many locations where where private data, such as our home addresses, are available, and there are other bills that address some of those locations, including, I know, one that's been referred to this committee. But this bill addresses just locations that relate to us as candidates and legislators. So the Campaign Finance Board, or the CFB, you'll probably hear that abbreviation during this discussion, and the Secretary of State's office. As I understand it, immediately after the events of June 14th, the Campaign Finance Board pulled down candidate addresses from places like the committee registration page. But there were other spots within the Campaign Finance Board website where our information may still be available, and the Campaign Finance Board felt legislation would help address those locations as well, making their actions of June permanent. So that's what this bill does. The bill affects legislators directly, so I didn't request anybody to testify, although there may be people who signed up as members of the public. But I do also have Campaign Finance Board Director Jeff Sigurdson, as well as Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State here, available to answer questions. And I appreciate members' consideration.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So the amendment, are we getting?
Forwarded it to people's emails. I could also share my screen.
Okay. Don't we need to print it? Do we not need to print it? So. Okay. Representative Freiberg, do you want to just describe your amendment? It's been emailed to members, and we can post it on the screen, but we do not have it as a printed copy. We're going to get it printed, but.
Yeah, if you'd like to take testimony first, and then we can move to the A17 Co-Chair Scott's amendment while we're waiting for the hard copies, I'd certainly be fine with that.
Yeah. Okay, so we are going to get it printed. It'll take a few minutes, so we'll move to the A17, if that's okay. And I don't think we have anybody signed up to testify on the bill. So
you know, so we don't need to do that. So Representative Chair Scott, please go ahead and with your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Freiberg. Yes, this is kind of some language that I, in reading the bill and listening to. Okay, I'm sorry. I move the A-17, Madam Chair.
Okay.
All right.
Please proceed. Sorry.
Yes. So there were some concerns as I read through the bill, and so this this amendment just addresses them. They're it's a page and line amendment, so it is a little harder to look at. But I think that the first piece is it allows up to $5,000, right? On one, well, this is to the original bill, not the A-16. So 4.1 to 4.3. Oh, this just adds security services in a different spot than where it was before. We removed the $25,000 non-campaign disbursement language for security services. I just felt like maybe there's a little too much room for nefarious activity when it came to that, and so removed that. And then if you move on down, 14.13, 14.29, it keeps physical security items exempt from campaign spending limits, but removes the exemption for ongoing security services to maintain consistency with how other personnel costs are treated. And then one of the last things it does is it removes the actively monitored email address option for independent expenditure disclaimers. And we weren't going to change that piece, right? That's staying, or is that the piece we're removing? We had a meeting this morning.
I think we're going to leave your.
Yeah, we're going to leave that amendment as is. Yes, yes, yes.
But there was another piece that we.
Right. For example, in an independent expenditure disclaimer, with only the name of the independent expenditure and generic Gmail address doesn't give the public clear information about who is funding the material. And so this would change that. It's incredibly important given that other campaign finance requirements don't apply to IEs. So that's a messed up version of my.
Could I just ask maybe nonpartisan
staff to do it.
Staff. I think what we have before us is the first engrossment. And I'm not sure, is the A-17 to the proper? It is. Okay, because I was a little confused by, yeah. Okay. So, Representative Freiberg, can you kind of have some response on all those items?
Sure. This to me seems like a friendly amendment. I appreciate your staff sending a summary of it as well yesterday, Co-Chair Scott. My main intention when I initially introduced the bill was to address the issue of locations where our address is visible. And some of these provisions related to security expenses came over from the Senate. I think they're generally good provisions, and I'm supportive of them. I do think you raised some interesting points. And I do actually, I think the provision there's a provision in here that states that anybody hired to provide security services can't, be campaigning as well. And that's already in an advisory opinion issued by the Campaign Finance Board. So this just kind of codifies that. I think that's a good provision. You certainly don't want to, have them feel any pressure to do that sort of thing. Like I said, I think codifying it into statute is a good idea. I'm fine with the provision deleting the reference to an actively monitored email address. I know there's another instance where that phrase is used, and we might want to consider a technical amendment on the floor just to make those consistent. I do think that would just, I'd view that as technical and would be fine. But otherwise, I'm certainly fine accepting this as friendly if that's the will of the committee and continuing to move this along. So appreciate you looking at this bill closely.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg. And we did discuss the other place where that actively monitored email address is mentioned, but we think it's appropriate to keep there because it's talking about the candidates' materials themselves. And I would venture to guess that most all of us on our website have an email associated with that is actively monitored,
or it, you know, it sends emails that we receive there to another personal email that we check regularly. So I feel like we felt this morning that it was good to keep that piece in there, but we can certainly discuss that as time goes on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott. And also, so we also discussed on line 19.16, your amendment is removing the actively monitored email on line 19.15, and then on the next line, 19.16, it says, or email. Does that phrase still need to be there, or should we be striking it? That might be more of a nonpartisan staff, just to make it consistent.
I'd be interested in Madam Chair, just knowing the significance of that.
Yeah.
I think you can certainly put in, you can use an email address where the address would have been. I think on independent expenditures, maybe it's a good idea to, let's strike it and just.
Ms. Davis, are you?
Who is the person?
Do you have a thought here? Or Mr. Hopkins?
Oh, here comes Mr. Gary.
Oh, we've got the expertise we need, I guess.
Yes,
okay, very good. Welcome to the committee. Have you been listening to the conversation?
Yes. Madam Chair, yes, I've been listening in the back row. So just an observation about the use of that term there. So that's a condition of what the website has to include. So if the independent expenditure disclaimer is going to list the website of the organization that supports it, the website at a minimum has to include both a mailing and an email address. So that's sort of a separate issue from only listing on the disclaimer an actively monitored email address, which might or might not give you more information about the organization. But if the group is going to list just the website, then the minimum standard is that it includes both on the website a mailing address and an email address to contact them.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. So I think part of our struggle here is that we're kind of not really the committee of jurisdiction for this issue, right? And that would be Representative Freiberg's committee, but we're allowing it because, you know, he's here and it's his bill, and so we have the expertise necessary to do it. So the A-17 is before us. Any other discussion to the A-17 amendment? Okay, all in favor of adoption of the A-17 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And thank you. We have our A-16 amendment. So, and it's being handed out. And if you would like to discuss that one, Representative Freiberg.
Sure. So this amendment makes one correction that was requested by House Research, and I'm glad Mr. Gehring is here in case we need more information about it. That's on line 1.2 of the amendment. Then it also makes changes requested by the Secretary of State. It provides clarification that street addresses on prior candidate filings are considered private data, and also outlines the transition process for candidates and clerks related to the new candidate affidavits, since the transition could happen in the middle of the filing period. And it has some language related to nominating petitions, and it states that they are not deficient if they are filed in the form that was in effect as of April 1st, 2026.
Okay, so I will move the A-16, if I haven't already, on behalf of Representative Freiberg. So is there any discussion to the A-16? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A-16 amendment, please say aye. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, give you a moment to actually have it, so in case you...
Who doesn't have one?
There is it. Here. Go ahead and hand that down. I'll give you a moment. So we'll just give everyone a moment to look at that in case there are any issues. Looking for some signal here when folks are ready to go. Yes? Okay. All right. Is there any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A16, right? A16 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Any final word, Representative Freiberg?
I appreciate members' consideration. I think this is an important issue.
Thank you, and thank you, and we appreciate you working on this too, because it's really, it's important to everyone. And so I will renew my motion that House File 3363, the first engrossment as amended, be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment, the bill is on its way to the general register. Thank you. Okay, so the moment we've all been waiting for. I'm going to just present this from here and just sort of explain what we're doing here. So I'm going to move House File 3874, which is the budget bill for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. And so just so members understand and the public understands what we're doing here, this is going to function as our budget bill such as it is this year. So it's kind of an odd year. We don't have budget targets, but the judicial branch has made a budget request. And so I'm bringing this up today for us to discuss and ask questions of the judiciary. And Mr. Shorba is online, I believe, waiting patiently to answer any questions that members have. And my intention is that we will lay this over and we will bring it up again a week from today and we will mark it up. So just like the process that we use for omnibus bills, we will use for this budget bill. And so my intention would be not to bring a DE amendment, but just to do individual amendments to do any modifications to the judiciary's bill. And we will have a slightly different amendment deadline. So it's usually 4 o'clock the day before. We're going to move it back to noon. So noon on Wednesday will be the amendment deadline if any members want to offer amendments to this bill. So I hope everyone understands that process. Is there any question about that process? And then on next Thursday, we'll mark up the bill. We will, vote on everyone's amendments. We'll see what goes on when we will attempt to move the bill. Okay, so that's what we're doing. So I'm welcome, Mr. Shorba. Thanks for joining us. So today we're just presenting. Mr. Shorba's here to answer questions that folks may have. And if you remember, we probably want to remind everyone about what is in the bill, maybe, just to, it's too many papers here, but, I've got the right bill here, but I was kind of looking for my little cheat sheet, but that's okay. We've got, they gave us a handout. So this budget request includes, and I'm not going to go through the numbers, and I think we got from fiscal staff when we came in today, we had a little grid that was put on our table here for us to remind us of what is in the bill. But there's a large piece of it is for judicial safety and security, including home security systems for personnel, including some additional personnel for the judicial branch. I think two FTEs were requested, I believe, and some additional money for paid family medical leave where the judicial branch was not given additional money for the employer portion. Mr. Shorbutt, what else am I missing here that you wanted to maybe mention and refresh members' memories about?
Sure. The only other components of the security package are personal data protection services. Currently, we contract with DeleteMe and funding for some protection for the Chief Justice at public events. If the bill does move forward, we'll have to eliminate Section 1, which we assume the State Patrol would take over that function, but they are understaffed and will not be able to, so we'll have to use the funding to contract with local law enforcement to do that if you decide to move it forward. And then finally, the grant program, $1 million one-time funding in 27 to do matching grants to courthouses and counties for security.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shorba. And so we got a breakdown from the judicial branch, which I don't know if it's been distributed, but I was given information that we, as the branch put together the funding package and what was included here, that you were thinking of counting for a number of, for judges and for administrators, to an amount of $1,000 per person for hardware for home security, and then an amount for monitoring, ongoing monitoring. Oh, thank you. And my, so the question that I had about that is, if the judiciary, some judges must already have home monitoring. I mean, it's hard to believe that some folks don't already have that. And so my question is, does the branch, you know, when we give the branch funding for something like this, of course, we don't micromanage. We don't say, oh, this piece must go to a judge and this piece must go over here. We just give you the funding with a lot of discretion for the branch. And I guess my question is whether the, how that would work for folks who already have a system. Whether you would be able to, say we didn't give you enough money to do it for all of the administrators, would the branch be able to, say, have enough discretion with the pool of money to be able to identify which employees may have a higher need for security than others so that it wasn't just everybody gets it? Do you understand where I'm going with that, Mr. Shorba?
I do, Madam Chair, and we would certainly work that out depending on what the allocation was. We did an estimate. There are about 580 people, judicial officers and administrators. That includes about 100 administrators. We certainly, if you don't give us all the money and we understand, then we would have to make some decisions. Maybe people with actual security threats, maybe people have gone through a threat assessment. We probably would not be doing retroactive. That's not how we calculated it. But even people who have a security system would be eligible for the $100 for ongoing maintenance. But we're not going to go back and give people all $1,000 who already have systems in place. That's not how we calculated it.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shorba, for being with us. I wonder if you could walk us through kind of the process for the grants that individual counties or courthouses can apply for, what's the process for that?
Mr. Sure. Shorba. So, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we have done this three times before, 2017, 2021, 2024 in different amounts. We probably follow the same timeline that we used the last time, which includes advertising in May that these grants are available. We then put together a panel, including members from the Sheriff's Association, Board of Public Defense, County Attorneys Association, State Bar, some members of the legislature, who sit and evaluate the proposals. The ideas are that these would be due in August and awarded in November and December. Again, as I mentioned, they require a 50% match, either in dollars or in staff time to put them together. So far, 65 counties have received funding, but we did have more applications than we had funding the last time. And some of the examples, I'm not going to go through all of them, but installing panic alarms, bullet-resistant glass, door locks, cameras, key readers, detection equipment, those kinds of things, mostly one time because it's one-time money, are the things that we have put together. So it's been very popular. And as the threats have gone up, as I said at our earlier hearing, the number of people who are contacting us to say we need to shore up our courthouses continues to rise. So thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for that, Mr. Shorba. And so how is it handled for smaller counties that may not have the budgets but still need some updates to their courthouse? Is that taken into consideration, their just kind of their ability versus a bigger county, a metro county or something?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it certainly is one of the principles that the committee established every time we've done this, is that we want to provide funding to as many counties as possible. So if we have $1 million budget, assume it, and if we get a $500,000 request from Hennepin, we're not going to give all $500,000 to Hennepin. We're going to try to spread out the funding as much as possible. And as I said, even if you don't have the budget, if you are going to do some training and we're going to pay for someone to help you with that, some of that time you use for the training would be counted against your match. So it doesn't have to all be money. And so we're trying our best to help every size county through the state.
Chair Scott, thank you. And Mr. Shorba, do you know whether the counties have another source of funding for the same kinds of items, or is this the only way we help them with this? Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, as far as I know, unless it comes from the county budget, there's no other direct source. I am not aware. I'm sure we would be aware if there were a lot of other courthouse grant programs. Most grant programs have dried up anyway. So this is the only supplemental source that I know of for counties, but I'm not the county budget expert, but that's what my understanding is.
Yeah, and Mr. Shorba, when these grants are decided upon, is there, maybe I missed this and you said it, but is there involvement by the BCA or any law enforcement agency or, you know, people with expertise and security to help decide kind of, you know, what, how to meet needs the best way and so on? I mean, how is that piece handled?
Madam Chair, in the past we have used the Association of Minnesota Counties as a member, but also primarily the Sheriff's Association, since they are in charge of security at county courthouses. So they have been represented and provide their expertise.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. Other members have questions? I saw Representative Van Binsbergen. Go ahead, and then Representative Moeller.
I got some questions about the paid family medical leave portion.
Go ahead.
And I see that you're requesting $644,000 in 26, and it just keeps going up every year. What my concern is, you know, I represent a lot of farmers, and there's small individual business owners that would benefit from some extra money for paid family medical leave as well. And can you just, you know, don't you go to the compensation council usually to make these recommendations for extra pay or salary?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not go to the compensation council. They are involved in making recommendations on judge salaries, but they are not involved in the paid family leave. This is basically a payroll tax. It's 0.44% of all the payroll that we pay out in the judicial branch. It's not individual salary calculations or anything like that. So all we did is calculate that number based on what our payroll is estimated to be. And it goes up because, of course, hopefully some salaries will go up eventually. And so that's where the calculation is. I understand your point, and we had a lengthy discussion about this at the last hearing, that there are many organizations and entities who are concerned about the employer share of this law. We are not here to judge the law or to comment on the law. We are only here because we feel as a part of government, the third branch of government, if we don't get this money, we are going to have to keep positions open. And we don't have money to pay for this. I had my staff calculate how many positions that will be. It's about 20 positions, which may not seem like a lot, but we only have about 2,000 employees in the branch. So every position takes away from doing our work. And we hope that we can have some equitable treatment because there was some operational efficiency money given to other branches, and we would like some money given to us. So we had to come forward with this request.
Representative Van Binsberg,
well, I just like to say I have lots of organizations in my district that would like some money given to them too.
Yeah.
It just concerns me that we're creating a special carve out for a very small group. So thank you.
All right. Well, I have to comment on that, Representative Van Binsberg. And I mean, this is the Judiciary Committee, and it's our responsibility to, be a partner with the judicial branch. And they are the third branch of government. They're not just some other small agency or business or something. So I just have to push back a little bit on that. I think it's pretty important. Representative Feist.
Thank you. And Representative Van Binsberg, you joined our committee more recently, so I feel like we've had this conversation, but I just have to chime in again with what I said last time. So I'm a small business owner. I have 10 employees. This tax is like de minimis. Like, it is unnoticeable to me in my payroll runs, which are like large, like twice a month. Like, I don't notice a difference at all. So speaking as a small business owner, like, this is not noticeable to me, and I've seen the benefit of paid family medical leave already within my team. And so just wanted to throw that out. And then also just to echo Chair Liebling, just the judicial branch protects our constitutional rights, and it is our obligation as the legislature to make sure that they have the funding they need. So I do think it's just fundamentally different than private sector. Thanks.
Other discussion? Other questions for Mr. Shorba? Okay. Not seeing any. So thank you for showing up virtually, Mr. Shorba. Thank you for answering questions. And you may hear more during the next week and as we draft amendments and prepare to mark up the bill on Thursday. So with that, I'm going to lay House File 3874 is laid over. And I'll give you back a few minutes, and we stand adjourned. Thank you.